3. Susanna closed her eyes and imagined a radio mic. When she opened them, the mic was there, standing on the console to the right of the two dials and the toggle switch. She had imagined a Zenith trademark, right down to the lightning bolt Z on the microphone's base, but North Central Positronics had been stamped there instead. So something was messing in with her visualization technique. She found that extremely scary. On the control panel, directly behind the microphone, was a semicircular, tricolored readout with the words Susanna Mio printed below it. A needle was moving out of the green and into the yellow. Beyond the yellow segment, the dial turned red, and a single word was printed in black. Danger. Susanna picked up the mic, saw no way to use it, closed her eyes again, and imagined a toggle switch like the one marked with awake and asleep, only this time on the side of the mic. When she opened her eyes again, the switch was there. She pressed it. "Eddie," she said. She felt a little foolish, but went on anyway. "Eddie, if you hear me, I'm okay, at least for the time being. I'm with Mia in New York. It's June 1st of 1999, and I'm going to try and help her have the baby. I don't see any other choice. If nothing else, I have to be rid of it myself. Eddie, you take care of yourself. I—" Her eyes welled with tears. "I love you, sugar. So much." The tears spilled down her cheeks. She started to wipe them away and then stopped herself. Didn't she have a right to cry for her man? As much right as any other woman? She waited for a response, knowing she could make one if she wanted to and resisting the urge. This wasn't a situation where talking to herself in Eddie's voice would do any good. Suddenly her vision doubled in front of her eyes. She saw the Dogon for the unreal shade that it was. Beyond its walls were not the deserty wastelands on the east side of the Y, but Second Avenue with its rushing traffic. Mia had opened her eyes. She was feeling fine again, thanks to me, Honey Bunch, thanks to me, and was ready to move on. Susanna went back. 4. A black woman, who still thought of herself as a Negro woman, was sitting on a bench in New York City in the spring of 99. A black woman with her traveling bags, her gunna, spread around her. One of them was a faded red. "Nothing but strikes at Midtown Lanes" was printed on it. It had been pink on the other side, the color of the rose. Mia stood up. Susanna promptly came forward and made her sit down again. "What did you do that for?" Mia asked, surprised. "I don't know. I don't have a clue. But let's us palaver a little. Why don't you start by telling me where you want to go?"
"I need a telephone. Someone'll call."
"Telephone," Susanna said. "And by the way, there's blood on our shirt, sugar. Margaret Eisenhart's blood, and sooner or later, someone's going to recognize it for what it is. Then where will you be?" The response to this was wordless, a swell of smiling contempt. It made Susanna angry. 5 minutes ago, or maybe 15, it was hard to keep track of time when you were having fun, this hijacking bitch had been screaming for help. And now that she'd gotten it, what her rescuer got was an internal contemptuous smile. What made it worse was that the bitch was right. She could probably stroll around Midtown all day without anyone asking her if that was dried blood on her shirt or had she maybe just spilled her chocolate egg cream. "All right," she said, "but even if nobody bothers you about the blood, where are you going to store your goods?" Then another question occurred to her, one that probably should have come to her right away. "Mia, how do you even know what a telephone is? And don't tell me they have him where you came from, either." No response. Only a kind of watchful silence. But she had wiped the smile off the bitch's face. She'd done that much. "You have friends, don't you? Or at least you think they're friends, folks you've been talking to behind my back. Folks that'll help you, or so you think. Are you going to help me or not?" Back to that. And angry, but beneath the anger, what, fright? Probably that was too strong, at least for now, but worry, certainly. "How long have we got before the labor starts up again?"
Susanna guessed somewhere between 6 and 10 hours, certainly before midnight saw in June 2nd, but tried to keep this to herself.
I don't know. Not all that long.
Then we have to get started. I have to find a telephone. Phone. In a private place.
Susanna thought there was a hotel at the First Avenue end of 46th Street, and tried to keep this to herself. Her eyes went back to the bag, once pink, now red, and suddenly she understood. Not everything, but enough to dismay and anger her.
"I'll leave it here," Mia had said, speaking of the ring Eddie had made her. "I'll leave it here where he'll find it. Later, if Ka wills, you may wear it again."
Not a promise exactly, at least not a direct one. But Mia had certainly implied.
Dull anger surged through Susanna's mind. No, she'd not promised. She had simply led Susanna in a certain direction, and Susanna had done the rest.
She didn't cousin me. She let me cousin myself.
Mia stood up again, and once again Susanna came forward and made her sit down, hard this time.
"What? Susanna, you promised. The chap—"
"I'll help you with the chap," Susanna replied grimly. She bent forward and picked up the red bag, the bag with the box inside it. And inside the box? The ghostwood box, with "unfound" written upon it in runes? She could feel a baleful pulse even through the layer of magical wood and cloth which hid it. Black 13 was in the bag. Mia had taken it through the door, and if it was the ball that opened the door, how could Eddie get to her now?
"I did what I had to," Mia said nervously. "It's my baby, my chap. And every hand is against me now, every hand but yours. And you only help me because you have to. Remember what I said, if Ka wills, I said."
It was Detta Walker's voice that replied. It was harsh and crude and brooked no argument.
"I don't give a shit about Ka," she said, "and you best be remembering that. You got problems, girl, got a rug monkey coming, you don't know what it is. Got folks say they help you, and you don't know what they are. Shit, you don't even know what a telephone is or where to find one. Now we gon' sit here, and you gon' tell me what happens next. We gon' palaver, girl, and if you don't play straight, we still be sitting here with these bags come nightfall, and you can have your precious chap on this bench and wash him off in a fucking fountain."
The woman on the bench bared her teeth in a gruesome smile that was all Detta Walker.
"You care about that chap, and Susanna, she care a little about that chap, but I've been mostly turned out of this body, and I don't give a shit."
A woman pushing a stroller, it looked as divinely lightweight as Susanna's abandoned wheelchair, gave the woman on the bench a nervous glance and then pushed her own baby onward so fast she was nearly running.
"So," Detta said brightly, "it's be pretty out here, don't you think? Good weather for talking. You hear me, Mama?"
No reply from Mia, daughter of none and mother of one. Detta wasn't put out of countenance. Her grin widened.
"You hear me all right. You hear me just fine. So let's us have a little chat. Let's us palaver."
Stave. "Kamala, come, Co. What you doing at my door? If you don't tell me now, my friend, I'll lay you on the floor." Response. "Kamala, come, foe. I can lay you low. The things I've done to such as you, you never want to know."
Fifth stanza. The Turtle. 1. Mia said,
"Talking will be easier. Quicker and clearer, too, if we do it face to face."
"How can we?" Susanna asked.
"We'll have our palaver in the castle," Mia replied promptly. "The castle on the abyss, in the banquet room. Do you remember the banquet room?"
Susanna nodded, but hesitantly. Her memories of the banquet room were but recently recovered, and consequently vague. She wasn't sorry, either. Mia's feeding there had been, well, enthusiastic, to say the very least. She'd eaten from many plates, mostly with her fingers, and drunk from many glasses, and spoken to many phantoms in many borrowed voices. Borrowed, hell, stolen voices. Two of these Susanna had known quite well. One had been Odetta Holmes's nervous and rather hoity-toity social voice. Another had been Detta's raucous, who-gives-a-shit bellow. Mia's thievery had extended to every aspect of Susanna's personality, it seemed. And if Detta Walker was back, pumped up and ready to cut butt,
That was in large part this unwelcome stranger's doing. "The gunslinger saw me there," Mia said. "The boy, too." There was a pause, then, "I have met them both before."
"Who? Jake and Roland?"
"Aye, they."
"Where?
When?
How could you? We can't speak here. Please, let us go somewhere more private."
"Someplace with a phone, isn't that what you mean? So your friends can call you?"
"I only know a little, Susanna, of New York, but what little I know, I think you would hear."
Susanna thought so, too, and although she didn't necessarily want Mia to realize it, she was also anxious to get off Second Avenue. The stuff on her shirt might look like spilled egg cream or dried coffee to the casual passerby, but Susanna herself was acutely aware of what it was. Not just blood, but the blood of a brave woman who had stood true on behalf of her town's children. And there were the bags spread around her feet. She'd seen plenty of bag folk in New York. Aye, now she felt like one herself, and she didn't like the feeling. She'd been raised to better, as her mother would have said. Each time someone passing on the sidewalk or cutting through the little park gave her a glance, she felt like telling them she wasn't crazy in spite of how she looked. Stained shirt, dirty face, hair too long and in disarray, no purse, only those three bags at her feet. Homeless, aye, had anyone ever been as homeless as she, not just out of house, but out of time itself, but in her right mind. She needed to palaver with Mia and get an understanding of what all this was about, that was true. What she wanted was much simpler. To wash, to put on fresh clothes, and to be out of public view for at least a little while.
"Might as well wish for the moon, sugar," she told herself. And Mia, if Mia was listening. "Privacy costs money. You're in a version of New York where a single hamburger might cost as much as a dollar, crazy as that sounds, and you don't have a sou. Just a dozen or so sharpened plates and some kind of black magic ball. So what are you going to do?"
Before she could get any further in her thinking, New York was swept away, and she was back in the doorway cave. She'd been barely aware of her surroundings on her first visit. Mia had been in charge then, and in a hurry to make her getaway through the door, but now they were very clear. Per Callahan was here. So was Eddie. And Eddie's brother, in a way. Susanna could hear Henry Dean's voice floating up from the cave's depths, both taunting and dismayed.
"I'm in hell, bro. I'm in hell, and I can't get a fix. And it's all your fault."
Susanna's disorientation was nothing to the fury she felt at the sound of that nagging, hectoring voice.
"Most of what was wrong with Eddie was your fault," she screamed at him. "You should have done everyone a favor and died young, Henry."
Those in the cave didn't even look around at her. What was this? Had she come here toe-dash from New York just to add to the fun? If so, why hadn't she heard the chimes?
"Hush, hush, love."
That was Eddie's voice in her mind, clear as day. "Just watch."
"Do you hear him?" she asked Mia. "Do you?" "Yes, now shut up."
"How long will we have to be here, do you think?" Eddie asked Callahan.
"I'm afraid it'll be a while," Callahan replied.
And Susanna understood. She was seeing something that had already happened. Eddie and Callahan had gone up to the doorway cave to try to locate Calvin Tower and Tower's friend, Deepnow. Just before the showdown with the wolves, this had been. Callahan was the one who'd gone through the door. Black 13 had captured Eddie while the pair was gone, and almost killed him. Callahan had returned just in time to keep Eddie from hurling himself from the top of the bluff and into the draw far below. Right now, though, Eddie was dragging the bag, pink, yes, she'd been right about that, on the collar side it had been pink, out from underneath the troublesome Cy Towers bookcase of first editions. They needed the ball inside the bag for the same reason Mia had needed it, because it opened the unfound door. Eddie lifted it, started to turn, then froze. He was frowning.
"What is it?" Callahan asked.
"There's something in here," Eddie replied.
"The box."
"No, in the bag. Sewn into the lining, it feels like a little rock or something."
Suddenly he seemed to be looking directly at Susanna, and she was aware that she was sitting on a park bench. It was no longer voices from the depths of the cave she heard, but the watery hiss and plash of the fountain. The cave was fading. Eddie and Callahan were fading. She heard Eddie's last words as if from a great distance.
Maybe there's a secret pocket.
Then he was gone. 2. She hadn't gone toe-dash at all then. Her brief visit to the doorway cave had been some kind of vision. Had Eddie sent it to her? And if he had, did it mean he'd gotten the message she'd tried to send him from the Dogon? These were questions Susanna couldn't answer. If she saw him again, she'd ask him. After she'd kissed him 1,000 times or so, that was. Mia picked up the red bag and ran her hand slowly down its sides. There was the shape of the box inside, yes, but halfway down there was something else, a small bulge. And Eddie was right, it felt like a stone. She, or perhaps it was they, it no longer mattered to her, rolled the bag down, not liking the intensified pulse from the thing hidden inside, but setting her mind against it. Here it was, right in here, and something that felt like a seam. She leaned closer and saw not a seam, but some kind of a seal. She didn't recognize it, nor would Jake have done, but Eddie would have known Velcro when he saw it. She had heard a certain ZZ Top tribute to the stuff, a song called Velcro Fly. She got a fingernail into the seal and pulled with her fingertip. It came loose with a soft ripping sound, revealing a small pocket on the inside of the bag.
"What is it?"
Mia asked, fascinated in spite of herself. "Well, let's just see." She reached in and brought out not a stone, but a small scrimshaw turtle, made of ivory from the look of it. Each detail of the shell was tiny and precisely executed, although it had been marred by one tiny scratch that looked almost like a question mark. The turtle's head poked halfway out. Its eyes were tiny black dots of some tarry stuff and looked incredibly alive. She saw another small imperfection in the turtle's beak. Not a scratch, but a crack. "It's old," she whispered aloud. "So old."
"Yes,"
Mia whispered back. Holding it made Susanna feel incredibly good. It made her feel safe somehow. "See the turtle," she thought. "See the turtle of enormous girth. On his shell he holds the earth." Was that how it went? She thought it was at least close. And, of course, that was the beam they had been following to the tower. The bear at one end, Shardik, the turtle at the other, Maturin. She looked from the tiny totem she'd found in the lining of the bag to the one beside the fountain. Barring the difference in materials, the one beside her bench was made of dark metal with brighter coppery glints. They were exactly the same, right down to the scratch on the shell and the tiny wedge-shaped break in the beak. For a moment her breath stopped, and her heart seemed to stop also. She went along from moment to moment through this adventure, sometimes even from day to day, without thinking much but simply driven by events and what Roland insisted was Ka. Then something like this would happen, and she would for a moment glimpse a far bigger picture, one that immobilized her with awe and wonder. She sensed forces beyond her ability to comprehend. Some, like the ball in the Ghostwood box, were evil. But this...
"Wow,"
someone said, almost sighed. She looked up and saw a businessman, a very successful one from the look of his suit, standing there by the bench. He'd been cutting through the park, probably on his way to some place as important as he was, some sort of meeting or a conference, maybe even at the United Nations, which was close by, unless that had changed too. Now, however, he had come to a dead stop. His expensive briefcase dangled from his right hand. His eyes were large and fixed on the turtle in Susanna Mia's hand. On his face was a large and rather dopey grin.
"Put it away," Mia cried, alarmed. "He'll steal it."
"Like to see him try,"
Detta Walker replied. Her voice was relaxed and rather amused. The sun was out, and she, all parts of she, suddenly realized that, all else aside, this day was beautiful, and precious, and gorgeous.
"Precious and beautiful and gorgeous," said the businessman, or perhaps he was a diplomat, who had forgotten all about his business.
Was it the day he was talking about, or the scrimshaw turtle?
"It's both," Susanna thought.
And suddenly she thought she understood this. Jake would have understood, too, no one better. She laughed. Inside her, Detta and Mia also laughed, Mia a bit against her will. And the businessman, or diplomat, he laughed, too.
"Ja, it's bod," the businessman said.
In his faint Scandinavian accent, both came out bod.
"What a lovely thing you have."
Yes, it was lovely, a lovely little treasure. And once upon a time, not so long ago, Jake Chambers had found something queerly similar. In Calvin Towers' bookshop, Jake had bought a book called Charlie the Choo-Choo by Beryl Evans. Why? Because it had called to him. Later, shortly before Roland's quartet had come to Colibrin Sturgis, in fact, the author's name had changed to Claudia E. Inez Bachmann, making her a member of the ever-expanding Quartet of 19. Jake had slipped a key into that book, and Eddie had whittled a double of it in Midworld. Jake's version of the key had both fascinated the folks who saw it and made them extremely suggestible. Like Jake's key, the scrimshaw turtle had its double. She was sitting beside it. The question was if the turtle was like Jake's key, in other ways. Judging from the fascinated way the Scandinavian businessman was looking at it, Susanna was pretty sure the answer was yes. She thought, "Dada Chuck, Dada Turtle, don't worry, girl, you got the turtle." It was such a silly rhyme, she almost laughed out loud. To Mia, she said, "Let me handle this."
"Handle what? I don't understand."
"I know you don't. So let me handle it, agreed?" She didn't wait for Mia's reply. She turned back to the businessman, smiling brightly, holding the turtle up where he could see it. She floated it from right to left, and noted the way his eyes followed it, although his head, with its impressive mane of white hair, never moved. "What's your name, Si?" Susanna asked.
"Matthiasen van Wyk," he said.
His eyes rolled slowly in their sockets, watching the turtle.
"I am second assistant to the Swedish ambassador to the United Nations. My wife has taken a lover. This makes me sad. My bowels are regular once again. The tea the Hotel Masseuse recommended worked for me, and this makes me happy."
A pause. Then, "Your Sholpada makes me happy." Susanna was fascinated. If she asked this man to drop his trousers and evacuate his newly regularized bowels on the sidewalk, would he do it? Of course he would. She looked around quickly and saw no one in the immediate vicinity. That was good, but she thought it would still behoove her to transact her business here as quickly as she could. Jake had drawn quite the little crowd with his key. She had no urge to do the same if she could avoid it.
"Matthiasen," she began, "you mentioned..."
"Mats," he said.
"Beg your pardon?"
"Call me Mats, if you would. I prefer it."
"All right, Mats. You mentioned, do you speak Swedish?"
"No," she said.
"Then we will speak English."
"Yes, I'd prefer.
I have quite an important position,"
Mats said. His eyes never left the turtle.
"I am meeting many important peoples. I am going to cocktail parties where good-looking women are wearing the little black dress."
"That must be quite a thrill for you." "Mats, I want you to shut your trap, and only open it to speak when I ask you a direct question. Will you do that?" Mats closed his mouth. He even made a comical little zipping gesture across his lips, but his eyes never left the turtle.
"You mentioned a hotel. Do you stay at a hotel?"
"Ja, I am staying at the New York Plaza Park Hyatt at the corner of 1st and 46th. Soon I am getting the condominium apartment." Mats seemed to realize he was saying too much again, and shut his mouth. Susanna thought furiously, holding the turtle in front of her breasts, where her new friend could see it very well.
"Mats, listen to me, okay? I listen to hear, Mistress Sai, and hear to obey."
That gave her a nasty jolt, especially coming out as it did in Matt's cute little Scandihoovian accent.
Do you have a credit card?
Matt smiled proudly. I have many. I have American Express, MasterCard, and Visa. I have the Euro Gold card. I have... Good. That's good. I want you to go down to the... For a moment, her mind blanked, and then it came. To the Plaza Park Hotel, and rent a room. Rent it for a week. If they ask, tell them it's for a friend of yours, a lady friend. An unpleasant possibility occurred to her. This was New York, the North, in the year 1999, and a person liked to believe that things continued to go in the right direction, but it was best to be sure. Will they make any unpleasantness about me being a Negro? No, of course not. He looked surprised. Rent the room in your name, and tell the clerk that a woman named Susanna Mia Dean will be using it. Do you understand? Ja, Susanna Mia Dean. What else? Money, of course. She asked him if he had any. Her new friend removed his wallet and handed it to her. She continued to hold the turtle where he could see it in one hand, while she riffled through the wallet, a very nice Lord Buxton, with the other. There was a wad of traveler's checks, no good to her, not with that insanely convoluted signature, and about $200 in good old American cabbage. She took it and dropped it into the boarder's bag, which had lately held the pair of shoes. When she looked up, she was dismayed to see that a couple of Girl Scouts, maybe 14 years old and both wearing backpacks, had joined the businessman. They were staring at the turtle with shiny eyes and wet lips. Susanna found herself remembering the girls in the audience on the night Elvis Presley had played the Ed Sullivan Show.
"Too cool," one of them said, almost in a sigh. "Totally awesome," said the other. "You girls go on about your business," Susanna said.
Their faces tucked in, assuming identical looks of sorrow. They could almost have been twins from the collar.
"Do we have to?"
asked the first.
"Yes," Susanna said. "Thank ye, Si, long days and pleasant nights," said the second.
Tears had begun to roll down her cheeks. Her friend was also crying.
"Forget you saw me," Susanna called as they started away.
She watched them nervously until they reached Second Avenue and headed uptown, then turned her attention back to Mats Van Wyck.
"You get a wiggle on, too, Mats. Hoss your freight down to that hotel and rent a room. Tell them your friend Susanna will be right along."
"What is this freight hossing? I do not understand. It means hurry up."
She handed back his wallet, minus the cash, wishing she could have gotten a longer look at all those plastic cards, wondering why anyone would need so many.
"Once you have the room nailed down, go on to where you were going. Forget you ever saw me."
Now, like the girls in their green uniforms, Mats began to weep. "Must I also forget the Sholpada?"
"Yes."
Susanna remembered a hypnotist she'd once seen performing on some TV variety show, maybe even Ed Sullivan.
"No turtle, but you're going to feel good the rest of the day, you hear me? You're going to feel like..."
$1 million might not mean that much to him, and for all she knew, 1 million kroner wouldn't buy a haircut.
"You're going to feel like the Swedish ambassador himself, and you'll stop worrying about your wife's fancy man. To hell with him, right?"
"Ja, to hell with that guy,"
Mats cried, and although he was still weeping, he was now smiling too. There was something divinely childish in that smile. It made Susanna feel happy and sad at the same time. She wanted to do something else for Mats Van Wyck, if she could.
"And your bowels?"
"Ja."
"Like clockwork, for the rest of your life," Susanna said, holding the turtle up. "What's your usual time, Mats?"
"I am going just after breakfast."
"Then that's when it'll be, for the rest of your life, unless you're busy. If you're late for an appointment or something like that, just say, Maturin, and the urge'll pass until the next day."
"Maturin."
"Correct. Go on now."
"May I not take the Sholpada?"
"No, you may not. Go on now."
He started away, then paused and looked back at her. Although his cheeks were wet,
His expression was pixie-ish, a trifle sly. "Perhaps I should take it," he said. "Perhaps it is mine by right." "Like to see you try, honky," was Detta's thought, but Susanna, who felt more and more in charge of this wacky triad, at least for the time being, shushed her. "Why would you say that, my friend? Tell, I beg." The sly look remained. "Don't kid a kidder," it said. That was what it looked like to Susanna, anyway. "Mats, Maturin," he said. "Maturin, Mats, you see?" Susanna did. She started to tell him it was just a coincidence and then thought, "Kala Callahan." "I see," she said, "but the Sholpada isn't yours, nor mine either." "Then whose?" "Plaintive." And before her conscious mind could stop her, or at least censor her, Susanna spoke the truth her heart and soul knew. "It belongs to the tower, Sai, the Dark Tower. And it's to there I'll return it, Ka willing." "Gods be with you, Lady Sai. And you, Mats. Long days and pleasant nights." She watched the Swedish diplomat walk away, then looked down at the scrimshaw turtle and said, "That was pretty amazing, Matt's old buddy." Mia had no interest in the turtle. She had but a single object. "This hotel," she said. "Will there be a telephone?"
3. Susanna Mia put the turtle into the pocket of her blue jeans and forced herself to wait for 20 minutes on the park bench. She spent much of this time admiring her new lower legs. Whoever they belonged to, they were pretty fine. And wiggling her new toes inside her new, stolen, shoes. Once she closed her eyes and summoned up the control room of the Dogon. More banks of warning lights had gone on there, and the machinery under the floor was throbbing louder than ever, but the needle of the dial marked Susanna Mio was still just a little way into the yellow. Cracks in the floor had begun to appear, as she had known they would, but so far they didn't look serious. The situation wasn't that great, but she thought they could live with it for now. "What are you waiting for?" Mia demanded. "Why are we just sitting here?" "I'm giving the Swede a chance to do his business for us at the hotel and clear out," Susanna replied. And when she thought enough time had passed for him to have done that, she gathered her bags, got up, crossed Second Avenue, and started down 46th Street to the Plaza Park Hotel. 4. The lobby was full of pleasant afternoon light, reflected by angles of green glass. Susanna had never seen such a beautiful room, outside of St. Patrick's, that was, but there was something alien about it, too.
"Because it's the future," she thought.
God knew there were enough signs of that. The cars looked smaller and entirely different. Many of the younger women she saw were walking around with their lower bellies exposed and their bra straps showing. Susanna had to see this latter phenomenon 4 or 5 times on her stroll down 46th Street before she could completely convince herself that it was some sort of bizarre fashion, Philip, and not a mistake. In her day, a woman with a bra strap showing, or an inch of slip snowing down south, they used to say, would have ducked into the nearest public restroom to pin it up, and at once. As for the deal with the nude bellies, would have gotten you arrested anywhere but Coney Island, she thought. No doubt about it. But the thing which made the biggest impression was also the hardest thing to define. The city just seemed bigger. It thundered and hummed all around her. It vibrated. Every breath of air was perfumed with its signature smell. The women waiting for taxis outside the hotel, with or without their bra straps showing, could only be New York women. The doormen, not one but two, flagging cabs could only be New York doormen. The cabbies, she was amazed by how many of them were dark-skinned, and she saw one who was wearing a turban, could only be New York cabbies. But they were all different. The world had moved on. It was as if her New York, that of 1964, had been a triple-A ball club. This was the major leagues. She paused for a moment just inside the lobby,
pulling the scrimshaw turtle out of her pocket and getting her bearings. To her left was a parlor area. Two women were sitting there, chatting, and Susanna stared at them for a moment, hardly able to credit how much leg they were showing under the hems of their skirts. What skirts, ha-ha! And they weren't teenagers or college cuties, either. These were women in their 30s, at least, although she supposed they might be in their 60s. Who knew what scientific advances there might have been over the last 35 years? To the right was a little shop. Somewhere in the shadows behind it, a piano was tinkling out something blessedly familiar night and day. And Susanna knew if she went toward the sound, she'd find a lot of leather seats, a lot of sparkling bottles, and a gentleman in a white coat who'd be happy to serve her, even if it was only the middle of the afternoon. All this was a decided relief. Directly ahead of her was the reception desk, and behind it was the most exotic woman Susanna had ever seen in her life. She appeared to be white, black, and Chinese, all whipped together. In 1964, such a woman would undoubtedly have been called a mongrel, no matter how beautiful she might have been. Here she'd been popped into an extremely handsome lady's suit and put behind the reception desk of a large first-class hotel. The Dark Tower might be increasingly shaky, Susanna thought, and the world might be moving on. But she thought the lovely desk clerk was proof, if any were needed, that not everything was falling down or going in the wrong direction. She was talking to a customer who was complaining about his in-room movie bill, whatever that might be. Never mind, it's the future, Susanna told herself once again. It's science fiction, like the City of Lud. Best leave it at that. I don't care what it is or when, Mia said. I want to be near a telephone. I want to see to my chap. Susanna walked past a sign on a tripod, then turned back and gave it a closer look. As of July 1st, 1999, the New York Plaza Park Hyatt will become the Regal UN Plaza Hotel, another great Sombra North Central project. Susanna thought, Sombra. As in Turtle Bay luxury condominiums, which never got built from the look of that black glass needle back on the corner. And North Central, as in North Central Positronics. Interesting. She felt a sudden twinge of pain go through her head. Twinge? Hell, a bolt. It made her eyes water, and she knew who had sent it. Mia, who had no interest in the Sombra Corporation, North Central Positronics, or the Dark Tower itself, was becoming impatient. Susanna knew she'd have to change that, or at least try. Mia was focused blindly on her chap, but if she wanted to keep the chap, she might have to widen her field of vision a little bit. She fights you every damn step of the way, Detta said. Her voice was shrewd and tough and cheerful. You know that too, don't you? She did. Susanna waited until the man with the problem finished explaining how he had ordered some movie called X-Rated by accident, and he didn't mind paying as long as it wasn't on his bill. And then she stepped up to the desk herself. Her heart was pounding. I believe that my friend, Matthiasen Van Wyck, has rented a room for me, she said. She saw the reception clerk looking at her stained shirt with well-bred disapproval and laughed nervously. I really can't wait to take a shower and change my clothes. I had a small accident at lunch. Yes, madam, just let me check. The woman went to what looked like a small TV screen with a typewriter attached. She tapped a few keys, looked at the screen, and then said, Susanna Mia Dean, is that correct? You say true, I say thank you, rose to her lips, and she squelched it. Yes, that's right. May I see some identification, please? For a moment, Susanna was flummoxed. Then she reached into the rush bag and took out an Oriza, being careful to hold it by the blunt curve. She found herself remembering something Roland had said to Wayne Overholzer, the Kala's big rancher. We deal in lead. The Rizas weren't bullets, but surely they were the equivalent. She held the plate up in one hand and the small, carved turtle in the other. Will this do? She asked pleasantly. What? The beautiful desk clerk began, then fell silent as her eyes shifted from the plate to the turtle. They grew wide and slightly glassy. Her lips, coated with an interesting pink gloss,
It looked more like candy than lipstick to Susanna, parted. A soft sound came from between them.
Oh.
It's my driver's license, Susanna said. Do you see? Luckily, there was no one else around, not even a bellman. The late-day checkouts were on the sidewalk, fighting for hacks. In here, the lobby was a doze. From the bar beyond the gift shop, night and day gave way to a lazy and introspective version of Stardust.
Driver's license,
the desk clerk agreed in that same sighing, wondering voice. Good. Are you supposed to write anything down?
No. Mr. Van Wyck rented the room. All I need is to check your... May I hold the turtle, ma'am?
No, Susanna said, and the desk clerk began to weep. Susanna observed this phenomenon with amusement. She didn't believe she had made so many people cry since her disastrous violin recital, both first and last, at the age of 12.
No, I may not hold it, the desk clerk said, weeping freely. No, I may not hold it. Ah, Discordia, I may not.
Hush up your snivel, Susanna said, and the desk clerk hushed at once. Give me the room key, please. But instead of a key, the Eurasian woman handed her a plastic card in a folder. Written on the inside of the folder, so would-be thieves couldn't easily see it, presumably, was the number 1919. Which didn't surprise Susanna at all. Mia, of course, could not have cared less. She stumbled on her feet a little, reeled a little, had to wave one hand, the one holding her driver's license, for balance. There was a moment when she thought she might tumble to the floor, and then she was okay again.
Ma'am?
The desk clerk inquired, looking remotely, very remotely concerned.
Are you feeling all right?
Yeah, Susanna said, only lost my balance there for a second or two. Wondering what in the blue hell just happened. Oh, but she knew the answer. Mia was the one with the legs. Mia. Susanna had been driving the bus ever since encountering old Mr. May I Not Take the Sholpada, and this body was starting to revert to its legless below-the-knee state. Crazy, but true. Her body was going Susanna on her. Mia, get up here. Take charge.
I can't. Not yet. As soon as we're alone, I will.
And dear Christ, Susanna recognized that tone of voice, recognized it very well. The bitch was shy. To the desk clerk, Susanna said, What's this thing? Is it a key?
Why, yes, Si. You use it in the elevator as well as to open your room. Just push it into the slot in the direction the arrows point. Remove it briskly. When the light on the door turns green, you may enter. I have slightly over $8,000 in my cash drawer. I'll give it all to you for your pretty thing, your turtle, your sholpada, your tortuga, your kavit, your...
No, Susanna said, and staggered again. She clutched the edge of the desk. Her equilibrium was shot. I'm going upstairs now. She'd meant to visit the gift shop first, and spend some of Matz's dough on a clean shirt, if they carried such things. But that would have to wait. Everything would have to wait.
Yes, Si.
No more ma'am, not now. The turtle was working on her, sanding away the gap between the worlds. You just forget you saw me, all right?
Yes, Si. Shall I put a do not disturb on the phone?
Mia clamored. Susanna didn't even bother paying attention. No, don't do that. I'm expecting a call.
As you like, Si. Eyes on the turtle. Ever on the turtle. Enjoy the Plaza Park. Would you like a bellman to assist you with your bags?
Look like I need help with these three puky little things, Detta thought. But Susanna only shook her head.
Very well.
Susanna started to turn away, but the desk clerk's next words swung her back in a hurry.
Soon comes the king. He of the eye.
Susanna gaped at the woman, her surprise close to shock. She felt goose flesh crawling up her arms. The desk clerk's beautiful face, meanwhile, remained placid.
Dark eyes on the scrimshaw turtle, lips parted, now damp with spittle as well as gloss. If I stay here much longer, Susanna thought, she'll start to drool. Susanna very much wanted to pursue the business of the king and the eye. It was her business, and she could. She was the one up front and driving the bus. But she staggered again and knew she couldn't, unless, that was, she wanted to crawl to the elevator on her hands and knees with the empty lower legs of her jeans trailing out behind her. Maybe later, she thought, knowing that was unlikely. Things were moving too fast now. She started across the lobby, walking with an educated stagger. The desk clerk spoke after her in a voice expressing pleasant regret, no more than that. "When the king comes and the tower falls, Sai, all such pretty things as yours will be broken. Then there will be darkness and nothing but the howl of Discordia and the cries of the Cantoi." Susanna made no reply. Although the goose flesh was now all the way up the nape of her neck, and she could feel her scalp tightening on her very skull. Her legs, someone's legs anyway, were rapidly losing all feeling. If she'd been able to look at her bare skin, would she have seen her fine new legs going transparent? Would she have been able to see the blood flowing through her veins, bright red going down, darker and exhausted heading back up to her heart? The interwoven pigtails of muscle? She thought yes. She pushed the up button, and then put the Oriza back into its bag. Praying one of the three elevator doors would open before she collapsed. The piano player had switched to Stormy Weather. The door of the middle car opened. Susanna Mia stepped in and pushed 19. The door slid shut, but the car went nowhere. "The plastic card," she reminded herself. "You have to use the card." She saw the slot and slid the card into it, being careful to push in the direction of the arrows. This time when she pushed 19, the number lit up. A moment later she was shoved rudely aside as Mia came forward. Susanna subsided at the back of her own mind with a kind of tired relief. Yes, let someone else take over, why not? Let someone else drive the bus for a while. She could feel the strength and substance coming back into her legs, and that was enough for now. 5. Mia might have been a stranger in a strange land, but she was a fast learner. In the 19th floor lobby, she located the arrow with 1911 to 1923 beneath it and walked briskly down the corridor to 1919. The carpet, some thick green stuff that was delightfully soft, whispered beneath her, "There, stolen shoes." She inserted the key card, opened the door, and stepped in. There were two beds. She put the bags on one of them, looked around without much interest, then fixed her gaze on the telephone. "Susanna!" Impatient. "What? How do I make it ring?" Susanna laughed with genuine amusement. "Honey, you aren't the first person to ask that question, believe me, or the millionth. It either will or it won't, in its own good time. Meanwhile, why don't you have a look around? See if you can't find a place to store your gunna." She expected an argument, but didn't get one. Mia prowled the room, not bothering to open the drapes, although Susanna very much wanted to see the city from this height, peeked into the bathroom, palatial, with what looked like a marble basin and mirrors everywhere, then looked into the closet. Here, sitting on a shelf with some plastic bags for dry cleaning on top, was a safe. There was a sign on it, but Mia couldn't read it. Roland had had similar problems from time to time, but his had been caused by the difference between the English language alphabet and Inworld's great letters. Susanna had an idea that Mia's problems were a lot more basic, although her kidnapper clearly knew numbers. Susanna didn't think the chap's mother could read at all. Susanna came forward, but not all the way. For a moment she was looking through two sets of eyes at two signs, the sensation so peculiar that it made her feel nauseated. Then the images came together and she could read the message. "This safe is provided for your personal belongings. The management of the Plaza Park Hyatt assumes no responsibility for items left here. Cash and jewelry should be deposited in the hotel safe downstairs. To set code, punch in 4 numbers plus enter. To open, enter your 4-number code and push open." Susanna retired and let Mia select four numbers. They turned out to be a 1 and 3 9s. It was the current year and might be one of the first combinations a room burglar would try, but at least it wasn't quite the room number itself. Besides, they were the right numbers, numbers of power, a sigil. They both knew it. Mia tried the safe after programming it, found it locked tightly, then followed the directions for opening it. There was a whirring noise from somewhere inside, and the door popped ajar. She put in the faded red Midtown Lanes bag, the box inside just fit on the shelf, and then the bag of Oriza plates. She closed and locked the safe's door again, tried the handle, found it tight, and nodded. The boarder's bag was still on the bed. She took the wad of cash out of it and tucked it into the right front pocket of her jeans, along with the turtle. "Have to get a clean shirt," Susanna reminded her unwelcome guest. Mia, daughter of none, made no reply. She clearly cared bupkis for shirts, clean or dirty. Mia was looking at the telephone. For the time being, with her labor on hold, the phone was all she cared about. "Now we palaver," Susanna said. "You promised, and it's a promise you're going to keep. But not in that banquet room." She shuddered. "Somewhere outside. Hear me, I beg. I want fresh air. That banqueting hall smelled of death." Mia didn't argue. Susanna got a vague sense of the other woman riffling through various files of memory, examining, rejecting, examining, rejecting, and at last finding something that would serve. "How do we go there?" Mia asked indifferently. The black woman, who was now two women again, sat on one of the beds and folded her hands in her lap. "Like on a sled," the woman's Susanna part said. "I'll push, you steer, and remember, Susanna Mio, if you want my cooperation, you give me some straight answers."
"I will," the other replied. "Just don't expect to like them, or even understand them."
"What do you—"
"Never mind. Gods, I never met anyone who could ask so many questions. Time is short. When the telephone rings, our palaver ends, so if you'd palaver at all—"
Susanna didn't bother giving her a chance to finish. She closed her eyes and let herself fall back. No bed stopped that fall. She went right through it. She was falling for real, falling through space. She could hear the jangle of the toe-dash chimes, dim and far.
"Here I go again," she thought. "And, Eddie, I love you."
Stave. "Kamala Jin Jive, ain't it grand to be alive? To look out on Discordia when the demon moon arrives."
Response. "Kamala come five, even when the shadows rise, to see the world and walk the world makes you glad to be alive."
Sixth stanza, The Castle Allure. 1. All at once she was falling into her body again, and the sensation provoked a memory of blinding brilliance. Odetta Holmes at 16, sitting on her bed in her slip, sitting in a brilliant bar of sun and pulling up a silk stocking. For the moment this memory held. She could smell White Shoulders perfume, and Pond's Beauty Bar, her mother's soap, and her mother's borrowed perfume. So grown up to be allowed perfume. And she thought, "It's the spring hop. I'm going with Nathan Freeman." Then it was gone. The sweet smell of pond soap was replaced by a clean and cold, but somehow dank, night breeze, and all that remained was that sense so queer and perfect of stretching into a new body as if it were a stocking one was pulling up over one's calf and knee. She opened her eyes. The wind gusted, blowing a fine grit in her face. She squinted against it, grimacing and raising an arm as if she might have to ward off a blow. "Over here," a woman's voice called. It wasn't the voice Susanna would have expected, not strident, not a triumphant caw. "Over here, out of the wind." She looked and saw a tall and comely woman beckoning to her. Susanna's first look at Mia in the flesh astounded her, because the chap's mother was white. Apparently Odetta that was, now had a Caucasian side to her personality, and how that must frost Detta Walker's racially sensitive butt. She herself was legless again, and sitting in a kind of rude one-person cart. It had been parked at a notch in a low parapet wall. She looked out at the most fearsome, forbidding stretch of countryside she had ever seen in her life. Huge rock formations sawed at the sky and jostled into the distance. They glistened like alien bone beneath the glare of a savage sickle moon. Away from the glare of that lunar grin, a billion stars burned like hot ice. Amid the rocks, with their broken edges and gaping crevices, a single narrow path wound into the distance. Looking at it, Susanna thought that a party would have to travel that path in single file, and bring plenty of supplies, no mushrooms to pick along the way, no pokeberries either. And in the distance, dim and baleful, its source somewhere over the horizon, a dark crimson light waxed and waned. Heart of the Rose, she thought, and then, no, not that. Forge of the King. She looked at the pulsing, sullen light with helpless, horrified fascination. Flex and loosen. Wax and wane. An infection announcing itself to the sky. Come to me now, if you'd come at all, Susanna of New York, said Mia. She was dressed in a heavy serape and what looked like leather pants that stopped just below the knee. Her shins were scabbed and scratched. She wore thick-soled huaraches on her feet. For the king can fascinate, even at a distance. We're on the Discordia side of the castle. Would you like to end your life on the needles at the foot of this wall? If he fascinates you and tells you to jump, you'll do just that. Your bossy gunslinger men aren't here to help you now, are they? Nay, nay, you're on your own, so you are. Susanna tried to pull her gaze from that steadily pulsing glow, and at first couldn't do it. Panic bloomed in her mind. If he fascinates you and tells you to jump. And she seized it as a tool, compressing it to an edge with which to cut through her frightened immobility. For a moment nothing happened. And then she threw herself backward so violently in the shabby little cart that she had to clutch the edge in order to keep herself from tumbling to the cobbles. The wind gusted again, blowing stone dust and grit against her face and into her hair, seeming to mock her. But that pull, fascination, glamour, whatever it had been, it was gone. She looked at the dog cart, so she thought it, whether that was the right name or not, and saw at once how it worked. Simple enough, too. With no mule to draw it, she was the mule. It was miles from the sweet, light little chair they'd found in Topeka, and light years from being able to walk on the strong legs that had conveyed her from the little park to the hotel. God, she missed having legs. Missed it already. But you made do. She seized hold of the cart's wooden wheels, strained, produced no movement, strained harder. Just as she was deciding she'd have to get out of the chair and hop-crawl her ignominious way to where Mia waited, the wheels turned with a groaning, oil-less creak. She rumbled toward Mia, who was standing behind a squat stone pillar. There were a great many of these, marching away into the dark along a curve. Susanna supposed that once upon a time, before the world had moved on, archers would have stood behind them for protection while the assaulting army fired their arrows or red-hot catapults or whatever you call them. Then they'd step into the gaps and fire their own weapons. How long ago had that been? What world was this? And how close to the Dark Tower? Susanna had an idea it might be very close indeed. She pushed the balky, gawky, protesting cart out of the wind and looked at the woman in the serape, ashamed to be so out of breath after moving less than a dozen yards, but unable to help panting. She drew down deep breaths of the dank and somehow stony air. The pillars, she had an idea they were called Merlins or something like that, were on her right. On her left was a circular pool of darkness surrounded by crumbling stone walls. Across the way, two towers rose high above the outer wall, but one had been shattered,
as if by lightning or some powerful explosive. "This where we stand is the allure," Mia said, "the wall walk of the castle on the abyss, once known as Castle Discordia. You said you wanted fresh air. I hope this does you, as they say in the Kala. This is far beyond there, Susanna. This is deep in End World, near the place where your quest ends, for good or for ill." She paused and then said, "For ill, almost surely. Yet I care nothing for that. No, not I. I am Mia, daughter of none, mother of one. I care for my chap and nothing more. Chap be enough for me, aye. Would you palaver? Fine, I'll tell you what I may and be true. Why not? What is it to me, one way or the other?" Susanna looked around. When she faced in toward the center of the castle, what she supposed was the courtyard, she caught an aroma of ancient rot. Mia saw her wrinkle her nose and smiled. "Aye, they're long gone. And the machines the later ones left behind are mostly stilled, but the smell of their dying lingers, doesn't it? The smell of death always does. Ask your friend, the gunslinger, the true gunslinger. He knows, for he's dealt his share of it. He is responsible for much, Susanna of New York. The guilt of worlds hangs around his neck like a rotting corpse. Yet he's gone far enough with his dry and lusty determination to finally draw the eyes of the great. He will be destroyed, aye, and all those who stand with him. I carry his doom in my own belly, and I care not." Her chin jutted forward in the starlight. Beneath the serape, her breasts heaved, and Susanna saw her belly curved. In this world, at least, Mia was very clearly pregnant, ready to burst, in fact. "Ask your questions. Have at me," Mia said. "Just remember, we exist in the other world, too. The one where we're bound together. We're lying on a bed in the inn as if asleep. But we don't sleep, do we, Susanna? Nay. And when the telephone rings, when my friends call, we leave this place and go to them. If your questions have been asked and answered, fine. If not, that's also fine. Ask. Or, are you not a gunslinger?" Her lips curved in a disdainful smile. Susanna thought she was pert, yes, pert indeed, especially for someone who wouldn't be able to find her way from 46th Street to 47th in the world they had to go back to. So, shoot, I should say. Susanna looked once more into the darkened, broken well that was the castle's soft center, where lay its keeps and lists, its barbicans and murder holes, its God knew what. She had taken a course in medieval history and knew some of the terms, but that had been long ago. Surely there was a banqueting hall somewhere down there, one that she herself had supplied with food at least for a while, but her catering days were done. If Mia tried to push her too hard or too far, she'd find that out for herself. Meantime, she thought she'd start with something relatively easy. "If this is the castle on the abyss," she said, "where's the abyss? I don't see anything out that way except for a minefield of rocks and that red glow on the horizon." Mia, her shoulder-length black hair flying out behind her, not a bit of kink in that hair as there was in Susanna's, Mia's was like silk, pointed across the inner chasm below them to the far wall where the towers rose and the allure continued its curve. "This is the inner keep," she said. "Beyond it is the village of Fedic, now deserted, all dead of the Red Death 1,000 years ago and more. Beyond that—" "The Red Death?" Susanna asked, startled, also frightened in spite of herself. "Poe's Red Death? Like in the story? And why not? Hadn't they already wandered into and then back out of L. Frank Baum's Oz? What came next? The White Rabbit and the Red Queen?" "Lady, I know not. All I can tell you is that beyond the deserted village is the outer wall, and beyond the outer wall is a great crack in the earth filled with monsters that cousin, diddle, increase, and plot to escape. Once there was a bridge across, but it fell long ago, in the time before counting, as 'tis said. They're horrors that might drive an ordinary man or woman mad at a glance." She favored Susanna with a glance of her own, a decidedly satiric one. "But not a gunslinger. Surely not one such as thee."
Why do you mock me? Susanna asked quietly. Mia looked startled, then grim.
Was it my idea to come here? To stand in this miserable cold where the king's eye dirties the horizon and sullies the very cheek of the moon with its filthy light? Nay, lady, 'twas you. So harry me not with your tongue.
Susanna could have responded that it hadn't been her idea to catch Preg with a demon's baby in the first place, but this would be a terrible time to get into one of those yes-you-did-no-I-didn't squabbles.
I wasn't scolding, Susanna said, only asking.
Mia made an impatient shooing gesture with her hand as if to say, don't split hairs, and half turned away. Under her breath she said, I didn't go to Morehouse or no house. And in any case, I'll bear my chap, do you hear?
Whichever way the cards fall, bear him and feed him.
All at once, Susanna understood a great deal. Mia mocked because she was afraid. In spite of all she knew, so much of her was Susanna.
I didn't go to Morehouse or No House, for instance. That was from Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison.
When Mia had bought into Susanna, she had purchased at least two personalities for the price of one. It was Mia, after all, who'd brought Detta out of retirement, or perhaps deep hibernation, and it was Detta who was particularly fond of that line which expressed so much of the Negro's deep-held disdain for and suspicion of what was sometimes called the finer post-war Negro education. Not to Morehouse or No House. I know what I know. In other words, I heard it through the grapevine. I got it on the Erie, dearie. I picked it up on the Jungle Telegraph.
Mia, she said now, whose chap is it besides yours? What demon was his father, do you know?
Mia grinned. It wasn't a grin Susanna liked. There was too much Detta in it. Too much laughing, bitter knowledge.
Aye, lady, I know. And you're right, it was a demon got him on you, a very great demon indeed, say true. A human one.
It had to have been so, for know you that true demons, those left on the shore, these worlds which spin around the tower when the prim receded, are sterile. And for a very good reason.
Then how? Your Din is the father of my chap, Mia said.
Roland of Gilead, aye, he. Stephen Deschaine finally has his grandson, although he lies rotten in his grave and knows it not.
Susanna was goggling at her, unmindful of the cold wind rushing out of the Discordia wilderness.
Roland, it can't be. He was beside me when the demon was in me. He was pulling Jake through from the house on Dutch Hill, and fucking was the last thing on his mind.
She trailed off, thinking of the baby she'd seen in the Dogon, thinking of those eyes, those blue bombardier's eyes.
No. No, I refuse to believe it.
All the same, Roland is his father, Mia insisted.
And when the chap comes, I shall name him from your own mind, Susanna of New York, from what you learned at the same time you learned of Merlins and courtyards and trebuchets and barbicans. Why not? 'Tis a good name and fair.
Professor Murray's Introduction to Medieval History.
That's what she's talking about.
I will name him Mordred, said she. He'll grow quickly, my darling boy, quicker than human after his demon nature. He'll grow strong, the avatar of every gunslinger that ever was. And so, like the Mordred of your tale, will he slay his father?
And with that, Mia, daughter of none, raised her arms to the star-shot sky and screamed, although whether in sorrow, terror, or joy, Susanna could not tell. 2.
Hunker, Mia said. I have this.
From beneath her serape she produced a bundle of grapes and a paper sack filled with orange pokeberries as swollen as her belly. Where, Susanna wondered, had the fruit come from? Was their shared body sleepwalking back in the Plaza Park Hotel? Had there perhaps been a fruit basket she hadn't noticed? Or were these the fruits of pure imagination? Not that it mattered. Any appetite she might have had was gone, robbed by Mia's claim. The fact that it was impossible somehow only added to the monstrosity of the idea,
and she couldn't stop thinking of the baby she'd seen in utero on one of those TV screens, those blue eyes. No, it can't be, do you hear? It cannot be. The wind coming through the notches between the merlins was chilling her to the bone. She swung off the seat of the cart and settled herself against the allure wall beside Mia, listening to the wind's constant whine and looking up at the alien stars. Mia was cramming her mouth with grapes. Juice ran from one corner of her mouth while she spat seeds from the other corner with the rapidity of machine gun bullets. She swallowed, wiped her chin, and said, "It can. It can be, and more, it is. Are you still glad you came, Susanna of New York? Or do you wish you'd left your curiosity unsatisfied? If I'm going to have a baby I didn't hump for, I'm going to know everything about that baby that I can. Do you understand that?" Mia blinked at the deliberate crudity, then nodded. "If you like. Tell me how it can be Roland's. And if you want me to believe anything you tell me, you better start by making me believe this." Mia dug her fingernails into the skin of a pokeberry, stripped it away in one quick gesture, and ate the fruit down greedily. She considered opening another, then simply rolled it between her palms, those disconcertingly white palms, warming it. After enough of this, Susanna knew, the fruit would split its skin on its own. Then she began.